have kids. I do. I've got a couple of boys, Tom and Ben. Hi, boys. I'm very proud of them, and I'm sure you're very proud of your children, too, if you have any, or perhaps your grandchildren. Or even if you don't have kids. I mean, kids are cute and cuddly, at least some of the time. And they're very important to us. And it's very important to remember that just like all other Americans, kids have constitutional rights and maybe even constitutional responsibilities. Today we're going to talk about two aspects of kids in the Constitution. The first is serious and not very happy. It's what do we do when there are allegations of abuse or neglect? There are a surprising number of constitutional issues that are implicated. And then on a happier note, we'll talk about a wonderful program you've heard me talk about before called We the People, which is designed to teach kids about our Constitution. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's all about the kids.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
The United States Constitution is not just for judges and lawyers, and certainly not just for law professors. It's for all of us, and all of us includes the kids. Now, we've talked about that from time to time on this show. We've talked about things like the free speech rights of students in schools. We've talked about other aspects of it in passing, but today we're going to focus on kids, and we're going to focus in two ways. A little later on, we're going to talk to a woman named Emily Voss, who runs a wonderful educational program called We the People for the entire Commonwealth of Virginia and even the District of Columbia out of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Emily and I are buds. We've worked together for years. She does a great job, and we're going to talk to her and to a student named Jack, and it's a really happy thing to look forward to. In the meantime, however, the first subject we're going to talk about is a much sadder and more serious subject that also involves kids. It's the issue of child abuse and child neglect. And that's rough stuff. Let's start with the constitutional rights. We all have a fundamental constitutional right to have children. We have a fundamental constitutional right to rear our children as we see fit, to have custody of our children, to educate them as we see fit. So it's no small thing when the state, the government, decides that it wants to interfere with those rights in some fashion and maybe even go so far as to take our children from us. How can that be? How could the state ever do that? Well, you see, the state has a power, and this is called the police power. It's a generalized power that it resides in every government to protect the health, the welfare, perhaps even the morals of its citizens. And so the state does have a strong interest and a strong corresponding power in protecting its weakest, its most vulnerable citizens, and that would be children. So as is so often the case, we have a very important state power conflicting with very important fundamental individual rights whenever there's an allegation of abuse or neglect. Today I'm going to speak with a friend of mine. Her name is Christy Wagner. Christy and I have known each other for a number of years. She works for the court-appointed special advocates program in Buchanan County and other counties, also in Southwest Virginia, where I live. And Christy and I have talked for years about getting some of my law students to be court-appointed special advocates. We'll talk about what that means in a minute. And we've also lately worked together closely because recently she asked me to be on the board of our local CASA program. So when I was thinking about this issue and thinking about the Constitution and kids, I could think of no one better to have on the show than Christy Wagner.
My name is Christy Wagner. I am the executive director of the 29th Judicial District Court-Appointed Special Advocates Program. And while that is quite a mouthful, we go by the acronym CASA, C-A-S-A.
That is quite a mouthful and a very impressive sounding title. What does one do who has that impressive title?
Well, my primary job is to recruit and train community citizens to become effective advocates for children who are brought into the court system due to abuse and neglect, so of course of no fault of their own. In addition to that recruitment effort and training, I also oversee cases and volunteers, in addition to the fundraising side of things that I write grants, host fundraisers, and keep the program going as we are a nonprofit organization.
And I happen to know a little bit about all the things you do because, roughly once a quarter, we have a board meeting, and you have kindly invited me to sit on your board. And once a quarter, we sit down and you go through all the stuff you've been doing. And you're right, you have many and varied duties, which you perform to an exemplary degree.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
It's important to have those board of directors meetings so that I can keep our board informed of what's happening, not only financially, because the board is our fiscal agent, but also to know that we're making progress, that we're retaining volunteers, that we're getting new volunteers so that we can keep our mission going.
Okay. Now let's talk about precisely what an advocate does. If someone volunteers for CASA, how do they fit into the judicial system?
Well, in Virginia, CASAs are considered a friend of the court and act as the eyes and ears for the judge. They go out and make home visits.
Well, let me put it in context. So there's some sort of judicial proceeding, often what, some sort of proceeding where the state has investigated parents for abuse or neglect?
Yes.
Okay, that's the beginning of all this. Okay.
The first step is the local Department of Social Services or Child Protection Services Agency, whatever it's called in your area. They go out and investigate an allegation of abuse or neglect of a child. If they deem necessary, they will remove that child and place that child with an appropriate relative or in a state-approved foster home. And then they bring that to court to present to the judge as to why the removal and the services that they're going to set out in place for the parent to regain custody of their child. It's at that time that CASA is appointed, hence our name, Court-Appointed Special Advocates.
Okay, so in this courtroom, at this stage in the proceedings, there will be a judge. There will be a representative of the state, the agency that's has removed the child and wants to get the child back at some point with its parents or some other disposition. The state, I'm assuming, has a lawyer there?
Yes.
Okay. And then, of course, on the other side of the table is the parents or one parent or somebody there if they show up, who typically want their children back. Now, do they have lawyers?
Yes, they are appointed, court-appointed lawyers, or they have the right to go out and hire their own attorney. Another key figure there is the guardian ad litem that is appointed by the state for the child as well.
Okay, so let's talk about those two parties, because you've got the judge, you've got the two parties, each of whom has a lawyer. So what does this guardian ad litem do?
Well, the guardian ad litem looks out for the child's best interest as well as their legal rights as well.
Okay, so that's a lawyer.
Yes.
So the guardian ad litem is a lawyer specifically appointed to represent the child's legal interest, which may be divergent from the parent's legal interest.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now we got three lawyers in the room representing three different parties, the state, the parents, the child. Now, where does the CASA volunteer fit in, the advocate?
Well, the advocate is appointed to the case to do an independent, unbiased investigation of all of the parties.
So that's the one person in the room other than the judge who doesn't represent anyone in particular except the system itself. Or is it the best interest of the child?
Best interest of the child, because we are also separate from the state system, although we most often have the same opinion in mind because we're all seeking as to what's in the best interest and safety of a child.
Okay, so you're not technically part of the state then?
No.
Okay, so you're an independent organization to be a separate set of eyes and ears to give objective, factual evidence to the judge in these very, very difficult cases.
Yes, which is why I think that CASAs are so productive because they're not confined to some of the state regulations. While we have our own regulations to follow and we are set forth in the Virginia Code, we have a little bit more flexibility going out on a weekend or more in an evening capacity to visit the parents.
And that's what you all do. Then the judge says, I want a CASA volunteer. Mm-hmm. So CASA sends a volunteer, and then what happens from that point forward? I mean, how does a CASA volunteer typically, what's the typical order of things that happen in a case?
Well, there are a series of hearings that will occur, three right off the bat within the first 60 days of a child's removal. And during that time frame, CASA is typically just getting appointed, just gathering the information. Once they've gathered information sufficient to make fact-based recommendations, then they submit a report to the judge with their investigation of the child situation, the parent situation, or caretaker, because it may be that the parents are absent and you've got an aunt or a grandparent taking care of the child, and that's where the child was removed from. Along with that investigation of all of those situations, the CASA is also going to recommend services for the child. services for the parents, because the goal is to get the child back reunited with their biological parents. But there obviously was some sort of breakdown in the home or the parenting style that is going to need services to be able to remedy that problem to reunite that family. Those could be such as substance abuse counseling, mental health services, home services, random drug screens, parenting classes, just a variety of things, whatever that situation calls for.
Okay, well, it sounds like there might actually be a little bit of risk involved for a CASA, for an advocate, because these people, you're sending them out into situations that have already been identified as dangerous, at least for a child. Do they have to, well, let's just, wow.
It is, mean, you know,
that's,
yes.
That's kind of scary to think about.
It is.
To begin with, do they go out escorted by the police, or do they need that? Or how do they actually go about getting entrance into these homes?
Well, I certainly encourage all CASAs to make that first contact with the parent, either face-to-face at court, at the CASA office, or if those options are not available, then by telephone, to let that person know that I'm coming out to your home and this is going to be the job that I'm performing. We do also send letters out trying to, as best as we can, explain the CASA role. We find that parents are pretty cooperative. If it's a parent that is going to work towards the services to regain their child, then they're typically pretty cooperative with CASA. If it's a non-cooperative parent, then it may be that the CASA just can't ever track them down. There have only been one or two situations in my almost 8 years with the program that have required the escort of a deputy. And the deputies are familiar with the CASA program and are always available to do that for us when needed.
Okay, well, I guess that does make sense. I was thinking that people being investigated would be hostile, but if they realize that their interest in getting their children back depends on getting a good CASA report, then I guess I understand the cooperativeness now.
Exactly. It also, although I believe that the state agencies have done what is best for the child by removing that child from that situation, it does help the parent to be more cooperative with a CASA to understand that we're not associated with the state. So we're not the person who came in and removed their child. While we are making recommendations as to whether or not that child can come back, they kind of have a different outlook on the CASA's perspective of the case.
Okay. Now, when a CASA volunteer shows up at the site, what do they typically do?
Well, they want to see the home, first and foremost, to make sure that the basic needs for all survival of children and humans is being met, that there's appropriate shelter, food, clothing, that the home is in good condition, and then start working from there as to what the needs are of the parents, whether it's a financial need, an educational need, transportation, or health, mental health, or otherwise, whatever brought that case to the court system, that the CASA can recommend services for them to rectify that issue. So they're going to sit down and talk in depth with the parent on what their needs are to be able to properly raise their child.
You've said several times that the goal is to get these children back with their parents, and I guess I understand that in one sense, but I also understand that that's a controversial perspective. There are going to be many people who are listening who are thinking, well, wait a second, these are abusive, neglectful parents. Why is that a goal? Why isn't the goal to get those kids out of there?
Well, just like there are laws to protect the children from being abused or neglected, or if that incident has occurred, to protect them by removing them from the home, the parents also have legal rights to rectify that problem, to regain custody of their child. It may be an isolated incident. There's a lot of different types of abuse and neglect out there. Most, when we think about this, we think just the actual physical abuse of a child. Whereas we find that neglect happens more often, and that could be due to situational factors of poverty, substance abuse, or mental health, something that could be remedied.
What are some of the common forms of neglect? What's a typical CASA case involve?
Substance abuse is one of the number one factors of child maltreatment nationwide. Mm-hmm. That comes second to poverty now. And so those basic needs that I mentioned earlier can sometimes be hard for parents to attain if they're living at poverty guidelines. While they may be striving and doing the best they can, just the lack of resources that they have may result in that child being neglected. The child may be loved and never physically abused or sexually abused, but just the basic needs that must be met. And that's where the Child Protection Agency intervenes. If they can provide support services without removing the child, then that's their first goal. Mm-hmm. But if they can't, or if the parent does not comply with those services and safety plans, then they deem it necessary to remove the child and kind of start from a different perspective.
So it might be as simple as someone who's trying real hard but just doesn't have enough money to keep the child properly fed or clothed, and then maybe some teacher at school says, you know, little Timmy or little Emily is looking awfully thin and is telling me that she's hungry all the time. And so it's just a matter of making sure that the parents have, what, an EBT card or food stamps or something of that sort. Maybe they're not aware of that or not following through with that, and you guys help them to make sure they've got the proper food? Is that?
Well, the CPS agency will do that. Mm-hmm. CASA only becomes involved once the child has been removed. So the parents weren't able to obtain or retain the necessary means to have the child stay in the home, so CPS removed them, then
Child
CASA,
Protective Services.
Yes, Child
okay.
Protection
but
Services.
But you might be trying to help them again, to
yes.
try to do that, and you know that now the kid's gone. Now you know what you need to do, and we're going to help you to do that. And that's—I hate to ever refer to neglect as being benign, but that's a relatively benign circumstance. It may be mostly attributable to poverty or perhaps ignorance or something. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Christy Wagner about the surprisingly constitutional area of child abuse and neglect. We've been talking about neglect after the break, and after our constitutional quiz, we'll talk about the much more serious subject of abuse. Stay tuned. Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz, and I was expecting the quiz guy, but today he's all dressed in his fancy green skin-tight leotard. It's all green with a green mask. Could it be
the Riddler?
I see. Well, what kind of riddle do you have for us today, Doug?
Hey, today we've got a great riddle.
A great riddle.
Here we go. I'm an island to myself with a strong statehood streak. I skipped the debate and had no representing signature. I was so late to ratify, the president was already picked. Who am I?
I guess Hawaii would be too easy and obvious an answer, but I don't know.
Well, I'm going to give you four choices.
And did I just blow one of those choices?
Choice A is Hawaii.
Well, maybe that's the right one.
Hint to listeners, it's not Hawaii.
Well, okay, I'm sorry. I blew it for you. What are the other ones?
B, Manhattan.
Manhattan. Well, that's an island.
C, Rhode Island.
Rhode Island.
It's even got island in the name.
Yes.
Or D, Ellis Island.
Ellis. Oh, that's a very important island as well. Let's see what our contestant has to say.
Well, contestant, could you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Tim Lindstrom.
Tim Lindstrom. And where are you from, Tim?
I hail from Johnson City, Tennessee.
You're sounding awfully familiar to me. Why is that? Have we met somewhere before?
This might be my second time on the program here, trying to seek out a bit of redemption for my previous appearance.
Now I remember you were just on the show a few weeks back, and you took a quiz, and it just didn't work out. What was that question you asked before, or you were asked?
I believe it was whether the President of the United States could be an ordained priest or minister.
That's right, and you got tripped up, if I may say so, because the idea was that you thought maybe that was too much religion and state mixing together, right?
That is accurate, absolutely.
Right, and that was actually, it was a hard question, because it does sound strange to have the idea of a priest or a minister as president, or a rabbi, perhaps, but when we really thought it through, we realized that they are citizens just like anyone else, and they have free exercise rights. And by golly, if they want to run for president and we want to elect them, it's perfectly okay. But you felt bad about not winning.
Absolutely. Felt the need for redemption. So
now is this a matter of pride, or is there some girl out there you really want to impress with your T-shirt?
Well, I am very happily married and have been for a number of years, so this is all about the pride.
It's all about the... Well, you can still want to impress your wife.
You make a very good point. We may need to edit that last part out. I hope she's not listening.
All righty, then. If I recall correctly, there were four answer choices. They were A, Hawaii, B, Manhattan, C, Rhode Island, and D, Ellis Island, even though I screwed up and kind of helped you out by eliminating answer choice A. Do you have any idea among the other ones?
Well, I'm going to have to keep my fingers crossed here and go with Rhode Island.
Now, why would you pick, that's answer choice C, why wouldn't you pick B, Manhattan, or D, Ellis Island?
Well, I believe that the question was about ratification, and if I am correct, Rhode Island is the only answer there that is actually a state.
Wait a minute, Manhattan's not a state?
To my knowledge, no. I believe Manhattan is part of the great city of New York.
I think they think of themselves as being their own nation, let alone state, but I think... Perhaps in a strictly legal sense, you may be right. So because Rhode Island is the only answer choice remaining after I blew Hawaii, the only one remaining after that that is actually a state, and therefore the only one that could have ratified, you think that's the answer. You're going to stick with that as your final answer?
I am going to do that. Rhode Island is it.
So, Doug, what is the answer?
Well, you know, it's got to be an island.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that it's got to be a state. You know, I'm an island to myself with a strong statehood streak.
Well, that's why I was thinking Hawaii.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
So, you know, Manhattan isn't going to make it. Ellis Island isn't going to make it. It's Rhode Island, of course.
Rhode Island.
You know, they skipped the debate. They never actually sent anyone to the Constitutional Convention.
Well, actually, I did know that because I happen to recall that they used to call Rhode Island Rogue Island.
Nice, nice, nice.
And indeed, because they didn't ratify, I think it was what, till like 1792 or something like
they
that?
They didn't ratify the U.S. Constitution until after Washington was president.
Right, exactly. And the funny thing about all of that is that when we had the bicentennial of the Constitution, either the mayor of Philadelphia or maybe it was the governor of Pennsylvania invited all of the other ratifying governors from the original 13 states to come to Philadelphia and talk about that. Rhode Island refused. And they said, we're not coming now. We'll come in a few years on the 200th anniversary of when we ratified. So they are still rogues.
You know, it's amazing. I'm expecting to see a bumper sticker that says, Rhode Island, the oh shucks, I guess we'll join you state.
Well, Tim, congratulations. You won this time.
I could not be happier.
Tremendous. No doubt you and your wife, who will now be very impressed with her learned and erudite husband.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again, Doug. That was a very good riddle.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let me continue my discussion with my friend Christy Wagner, who is the head of the local court-appointed special advocates program, which is assigned to advocate for children in situations of neglect, which we were recently talking about, and unfortunately also in situations involving abuse. Do you ever get involved in cases where there's been actual, you mentioned physical or sexual abuse? Do you encounter those situations as well?
Yes, we do. I think those are the hardest to wrap your mind around that you're going to work towards getting this child back into a home where they have been physically or sexually abused.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
It is very tough.
I'm going to guess, though, that that's a situation where maybe there was an abuser there who is no longer there.
That could be the situation.
It was the evil boyfriend or something of that sort. And so maybe you come in after boyfriend's gone or in jail or something?
Yes, absolutely. Children are removed from domestic violence cases in the home where maybe a party has been arrested and, as you said, no longer in the picture. Or it could be a subfactor of mental health and substance abuse that's not being properly treated that resulted in either an isolated or an ongoing abusive situation. And so once that parent has completed the necessary treatment and maintains that treatment and that sobriety, then the child can go back.
Okay. Wow. What a tough situation to deal with. So after the visit, or visits, I imagine sometimes there's more than one visit, the CASA goes back to the court and submits this report.
Yes.
And is that the end of it? They just submit the report and it's done, or do they testify in court, or what?
Well, it depends on how much progress the parent has made. At the 6-month foster care review hearing, if the parent has made a substantial amount of progress that the judge sees that the child can go back home either on a trial placement or with full custody going back to the parents, then that may end the CASA service. Typically, the child does not just go back and everybody walks away, because how can we ensure ensure the safety of the child. Mm-hmm. So a trial home placement is often attempted where CASA is now going back into the parent's home with the child present. So they're seeing that the parent has maintained sufficient food, has maintained sobriety, maintained a home, the child is going to school, the child is thriving in the environment just as they would have been in a foster care placement. Once that is sustainable for 4, 5, 6 months, then the court may release custody back to the parent, and that's when everyone walks away and certainly hopes for the best. There are situations where parent makes a few steps of progress forward and then a few steps back. So a case can go on for quite some time. The laws state that if a child remains in foster care from 12 to 15 months with no progress being made by the parent for reunification, then we can seek an alternative to return home. And that's where we might be looking at one of the hardest things, which is to terminate a parent's rights indefinitely and allow that child to be adopted by either a relative or a non-relative.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. What's your greatest success story? What if you think back on the cases you've managed, tell me about one where everything worked out really well.
Success can be identified a couple of different ways in CASA. Of course, the first would be if the child returned back to their natural parents, custody went back, everyone involved is out of the picture, and the parent can maintain that and go on with life with that child as if there had been no prior intervention.
A reunited, happy family.
Yes.
That's the goal. Okay. Have you encountered that? I mean, does that ever happen?
I have seen a couple. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I've been around long enough now, though, to also see those reunifications fall apart a year, 2 years, 3 years later, and the child return to the system. And I think those might be the toughest because we viewed it as a success. The mother or father did what they needed to do. They got their child back. Things appeared to be going okay. We walk away from it, the court, DSS, and then something happens and it falls apart.
Well, I didn't want to hear that, Christy. I wanted to hear the success story. Tell me about a happy outcome that's still happy.
Another success that might be viewed by CASA is that if a parent did not regain custody, maybe they even made the choice that I'm not going to be able to get it together, so I'm going to give my child a better chance with someone else, and they will voluntarily relinquish their rights. And that child is then adopted by someone else and goes on to have a very fulfilled life. Some see that as a success, and I do see that as a success in a lot of ways. However, we would like to see more reunifications. Under my belt, I only have a couple of reunifications that have remained reunified. And I say that with some caution because I don't know. I'm not still overseeing those families.
Right.
Once we're out of it, I don't know that they don't move away, that they're not, you know, somewhere else in foster care. It's my
right.
hope that things continue to stay on a good path, but we're never really guaranteed that.
Okay. Now let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Tell me about one of your hardest cases. Now, obviously, we won't mention names here, but
certainly.
Tell me the one that really still keeps you up at night.
I think the type of abuse that bothers everyone is sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to justify an act of sexual abuse upon a child, regardless of who the perpetrator is, whether it's a parent, a paramour in the situation, and another relative. I think those are the toughest ones. It's leaving lifelong scars emotionally on these children,
mm-hmm.
Not just the physical that might heal and go away, but something that they're going to have to deal with for the rest of their lives, because that this happened to them from someone that they trusted. They may have a hard time ever trusting anyone else again. So I do believe the sexual abuse are the most difficult, regardless of the age of the child or the sex of the child or the nature. It's just hard to justify how that happened. We can justify that dad lost his job and then walked out on mom and left mom in a poverty-stricken situation where she's having trouble keeping the power on and buying appropriate food. You get services in there to empower that mother to then be a single parent and provide for the children. You can see that how that might happen, but it's really hard to understand sexual abuse and to move towards a goal of reunification.
Yeah, you can say that again. It turns one's stomach even to contemplate it. So I'm guessing that occasionally, when these CASA volunteers submit their report, sometimes the recommendation is don't ever take that kid back to that house.
Yes, yes,
and
that is true.
Go ahead and begin the process of terminating their rights. And when a parent's rights are terminated, at least within the Commonwealth of Virginia, that means it's over. It's like that kid is not yours anymore. You've got no legal right at all.
Exactly.
What does that take? I mean, that's a pretty significant undertaking. What sort of proof does that require? What sort of standard?
That's where the CASA may be called to testify, because, of course, their written report is submitted to the court, and any parent's attorney, if they're doing their job, they're going to try to poke holes in that report. So they're going to want to question the CASA mm-hmm. on their visits, on the information that they have supplied. CASAs often take photographs. They request medical records, school records. They really delve into every aspect of this child and family's life so that they can make fact-based recommendations, because it is not easy to recommend that you legally separate a child from its mother and father permanently. As you said, they have no longer any legal ties to that child, which also affects, and I think a lot of people don't realize, that affects the cousins, the aunts, the people who are not involved in the abuse of this child. It takes away all of those family members as well.
Yep. And I guess ideally, if you have to terminate rights and seek adoption, you're going to try to look to a member of the extended family.
Yes.
Right? Would you say the majority of such adoptions occur that way? They go to the grandmother or an aunt or an uncle or something, or do they go to complete strangers?
You know, it's about 50-50, really, because
really?
Sometimes the family members maybe don't want to get involved into that level. They will be willing to take placement of the child until mom or dad can get their things straight to get the child back. But when it comes to actually severing those ties, that puts them in a real predicament as well, because this is their relative. Are they going to keep that safety? And then that safety becomes their responsibility also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough. That's going to lead probably to an estrangement between the adopting family member and the one that's been terminated.
Yes, it could.
Youch, tough situation. And I'm guessing also that such adoptions are not always available. I'm guessing there are some kids who are removed from houses, parental rights are terminated, and they just stay in foster care, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, there are a number of children in the state of Virginia, as well as, you know, across all of the United States, that are in foster care, not maybe finding that right adoptive placement or that home. There is definitely a lack of foster parents and adoptive placements as well. A lot of times you'll see that maybe a foster parent entered into the fostering as a temporary, but they become so bonded to the child that they can't bear to let the child go, so they will enter into an adoption. But that's a big undertaking as well, especially when you talk about a child who has been so abused or traumatized, or prenatal substance exposure, the things that may come out later in life that you have to be prepared to handle. That it was of no doing of yours. You've been parenting, you know, as best you can or superbly, but genetics and what happened to that child in the past can rear up in later years and cause some families a lot of heartache.
Mm. Well, this is obviously extremely important work, and I'm also going to guess that there are funding issues that
yes.
you face. And that there's always a need to support this. So this is your opportunity. How can people help financially with CASA?
Well, we do request grants, but those are getting harder and harder to come by as
right.
our just United States economy is,
sure.
is in some turmoil.
Well, how can someone who's listening right now help you out in CASA?
They can directly donate to the CASA program.
And how would they do that?
They can mail a payment to or a donation to us at Post Office Box 1977, Grundy, Virginia, 24614. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so any donations that are made, I will also return a tax deductible receipt for that. And we host several fundraising events that our community can come out and support so that they're getting something back in return for their dollar or $2 or whatever donation.
Sure.
We have annual 5K races. We've had an annual car show.
The car
show.
Couple of years.
Yes, where all the antique cars are. That's a fun one.
We've had cornhole tournaments. We have an awesome holiday auction, which is just perfect for Christmas shopping and a lot of good fun. Mm-hmm. And coming up in April, so starting tomorrow, every Friday in the month of April, we will be hosting a bake sale because April is nationally recognized as Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month.
And a lot of those baked goods have blue frosting, don't they?
Yes, because we are supporting the Blue Ribbon Campaign. As you're probably familiar, there's ribbons and colors for everything. And so we pass out a blue ribbon when someone stops at our bake sale so that it can spark the conversation. Hey, what's that blue ribbon about? And they can say, well, this is to help raise awareness that children are being abused and neglected, and this is how we can prevent it. This is what we can do to intervene.
Is there an online method by which people could donate? Do you have a website?
Yes, we do have a website, www.29thjdcasa.org.
Okay,
so
that's a
that
mouthful.
Big name again.
That's a mouthful. They could simply Google 29th Judicial District CASA.
Exactly.
And that's the website that
and
they
the
would
website
get.
Is just the abbreviation of our name, 29thjdcasa.org.
Okay. And that is, can they donate directly online, or would they simply be able to use that to find your physical address and then send it in the mail?
Right now, we're not able to take donations online, but I am working to set up PayPal, or actually, I do have it set up, but not in the receiving aspect.
Okay.
But our address is there. So that they can mail and they can learn more about the program,
sure.
Learn how to volunteer as much as we need.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that because that's the way. And I mentioned money first because in a sense, that's the easiest thing to do if you happen to have somebody that you can spare. And I know that a lot of people do. And that's a great thing. Write a check. I mean, that's always helpful, always important. But the real help that you always need, and I know this because for years you've been coming by the Appalachian School of Law and recruiting my law students, is for volunteers. So
absolutely.
Let's talk about how a person becomes a CASA volunteer.
Well, the first thing to do is contact us, and we will provide all of the information necessary to get started. As you might imagine, we are working with very vulnerable children, so we have a very thorough screening process to our volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
A volunteer must complete and pass a criminal background check, a child protection services check, as well as some very intense training so that they are well equipped to go in and effectively advocate for children. National CASA requires 30 hours of training and 6 hours of courtroom observation. So those are things that have to be done before we can even get you started on a case.
Well, now don't scare people off now, Christy, because I know a lot of my law students go through this. So even though it is really good screening and really good training, it's something that is doable, right?
It certainly is doable, and it will pay off when you serve that first child and intervene and provide the protection by the recommendations to keep that child from being abused or neglected in their home.
Yeah, about the most fulfilling work, most important work one can imagine. So anything else you want to tell us about CASA before we wrap up here?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, National CASA. So this is a national organization.
Right.
And you can find a CASA program, hopefully, within any area that you live.
Mm-hmm.
Some CASAs serve an entire judicial district. Some may serve one county, or there may be two programs serving a judicial district. So while I certainly want to see volunteers in my district, the 29th Judicial District, you can seek out to support CASA anywhere or even nationally. National CASA also accepts donations to help fund grants for the local programs, such as myself.
Right. Well, kids need help everywhere, so I second that. Of course, we'd love to see you get lots of donations at your local branch, but of course, any bit helps.
And absolutely.
So that's absolutely marvelous. Well, Christy, God bless you and your family of volunteers for all the important work that you do and all the foster parents out there and all the adoptive parents. There are children who need help, and we've got to help them. So thank you for all that you do.
Thank you for having me.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with Christy Wagner of the Court-Appointed Special Advocates Program all about the good work that she and CASA do to help abused and neglected children, and a surprisingly constitutional area of law. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and have a happier subject involving kids. We'll talk with Emily Voss of Montpelier about the We the People program. Stick around.
James Madison was a politician and scholar who, until the mid-1790s, really only visited in Orange County. He wrote about the plantation Montpelier during visits to home and encouraged scientific farming methods. Also, he purchased supplies in Philadelphia, and he sometimes oversaw the marketing of produce from Montpelier. But otherwise, he left things to his father and brother. As late as 1787, he held virtually no property in his own name, which has led some students to rank him among the least substantial members of the Federal Convention from a standpoint of wealth. A man named Forrest MacDonald used Orange County land, personal property, and tax records and estimated that James Madison's wealth in 1787 was 560, quote, ill-kept acres, valued at $725, six adult slaves, three slave children, and five horses. The 560 acres were a gift from his father, part of a long-term plan for gradual transfer of the Montpelier estate to James Madison. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today we're talking about kids and the Constitution, and one of my favorite ways to relate those two subjects is to talk about we the people.
Every year, for a number of years now, I have volunteered as a judge with a wonderful, wonderful organization, a wonderful program, a wonderful competition called the We the People competition. It's a nationwide competition having to do with the United States Constitution. It is for both middle schoolers and for high schoolers, and there are regional competitions, there are state-level competitions, there's even a national competition. And it was actually through the Virginia State competition several years ago that I originally met Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady for a number of years, and that was sort of the genesis of my connection with Montpelier, because Kelly used to coordinate the entire Virginia State program for the state of Virginia. But we decided we didn't like Kelly too much, and so we got rid of her, and we replaced her with another. Oh, of course we didn't. Everybody loves the quiz lady. No, Kelly decided to move on to another position, and she decided to start a family, and we wish her well. And if she's listening, hey, Kelly, hope everything's going great. But we got an equally nice lady. Her name is Emily Voss, and she took over Kelly's position, and she's now the We the People lady. And Emily's with us today. How are you, Emily?
Hey there, Stuart. I'm doing really well.
Tremendous. Well, we're going to talk all about We the People today because you just recently finished running the entire state competition, didn't you?
Yes, we finished the Virginia State competition the last weekend of January, and then we went right from there to our D.C. competition.
You do that one, too. That's right.
We do that one as well.
Golly gee.
Virginia State and D.C. citywide finals.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you look like you're kind of recovered.
More or less recovered.
We're glad you could make it into the studio today. We got an extra treat for you, though, too. We've got one of the contestants with whom I had a very interesting interchange. His name is Jack. Jack, are you there?
I am here.
Tremendous. And where are you from, Jack?
I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I'm at Freeman High School in the Center for Leadership, Government, and Global Economics.
Absolutely. And in fact, Freeman is a perennial powerhouse there. Who's your coach there at Freeman?
Rob Peck is our coach. He's coached the team for a number of years, and he does a really fabulous job.
Shout out to Rob Peck. I know Rob very well. We've known each other for a number of years, and you're absolutely right, Jack. Every year he brings powerhouse contenders to the Virginia State Finals, and it was really a great thing to do that this year. This particular year, we had a really funny exchange. I believe the question that I was judging one of your panels, and it was about the Supreme Court, wasn't it?
Right, yes. We were talking about whether there should be term limits on Supreme Court justices, and the question was just, should there be term limits? And my unit chose generally, I think, to take some contrarian stances. And we said, yes, there should be term limits, and we proposed a number of different options. And when we presented our opening statement, I ended it with this kind of forceful call for term limits for Supreme Court justices, and your first question, I remember, was, why do you hate old people? And it kind of went from there, where we were talking about the ramifications of such a choice of having any sort of term limits for justices, and how that would affect the court and how it would affect the uh, the stance of the justices on the court.
Well, to your great credit, Jack, and to the great credit of your teammates, there was only a moment when you looked at me at shock, with shock and dismay in your eyes. I know you'd expected a much more learned question from me, but then you immediately assured me, if I recall correctly, that you did not, in fact, hate old people, but that you had other reasons for limiting these terms. What were some of those reasons again?
Right. Well, we talked a little bit about how the selection process for Supreme Court justices is highly politicized. And one of the points we made was that when you are selecting justices, when the president's looking at that and when the Congress is looking at that, they're thinking about it in terms of lifetime appointments, and it becomes such a huge deal and the stakes are so high. And if you were to implement term limits, then the stakes might be lowered somewhat, and it would be a question of maybe over the next 15 years or something like that, as opposed to appointing somebody younger and then having them serve for many, many decades, as we see often these days. And also there's the question of age discrimination, where if the president's nominating someone to serve on the Supreme Court, he has an incentive to nominate someone who's younger rather than someone who's older, because then they'll have that influence on the court for more years. And that's something that could be averted under a system of term limits.
Well, see, that's actually, well, that was my favorite aspect of your answers, because it turned my question on its head. You know, I was positing that you hated old people, and then you all pointed out that, in fact, this could help old people, because an old person who, maybe 65 years old, who might be at sort of the peak of his or her judicial career and would make an excellent Supreme Court justice, might not get picked because they're looking for somebody who's going to be on there for 30 or 40 years. But this would allow such a person to be picked and still have maybe 15 good years left. And Emily, I'm looking at you now. You've been listening here and smiling this whole time and nodding. I'm thinking you're good agreeing with me that the sophistication of Jack's answer here really exemplifies what's so impressive about We the People.
Absolutely. I really love seeing how the students step up to the challenge, but not only the questions that they have prepared statements for are always very sophisticated and well above their years, but the fact that they can answer judges such as yourself, throwing them curveball questions and being prepared to answer on the spot, is just fantastic. And we see it with both high school students and middle school students.
That's right. You're a high school student, aren't you, Jack?
I am, yes.
And you're just barely 18 years old, aren't you?
That's correct.
You're a young whippersnapper. And so that's when I was 18 years old, quite frankly, Emily, I had no clue.
I didn't either, Stuart.
Yeah, I didn't either. So this is a very, very inspiring when we hear things of this sort. What was your favorite moment at We the People, if I may ask, Jack?
I think my favorite moment, I would say, was when when you asked me that question and we went back and forth a little bit, and then I was forced to kind of turn the answer on its head again, because I personally don't believe in term limits for Supreme Court justices, and we were arguing it because it was fun. So I had the opportunity kind of to argue both sides there and to take that lawyerly two-handed approach and talk about my hero, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, for a little bit in his older years and some of the stuff he did with regard to freedom of speech.
Well, it sounds to me like you really are a constitutional fan. And is this something you do think you want to pursue? Do you want to go to law school down the road, do you think?
I definitely would like to study something with related to policy and government and that sort of thing. I'd consider law school. It's certainly something on the table. I've done some work with the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia, and enjoyed everything I've done over there the past few months. And going forward, I definitely want to do something related to government, be that policy or law or anything like that.
Tremendous. In fact, you're in the middle of applying for colleges now. Have you gotten any college acceptances yet? It's about that time of year, isn't it?
I've been admitted into Princeton and into the
University. Oh, well, that's ended. That ends the question then, doesn't it? I mean, there's no better
place. Stuart, you're a little biased.
I'm sorry. Well, no, I'm James Madison, right? I mean, College of New Jersey. You want to go where James Madison went, right?
It's certainly on the table. It definitely is.
And where I went, right? I mean,
that's right.
James and I were there at the same time, right?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, he don't even think that's funny. He thinks I'm as old as James Madison. This guy really does think I'm old and decrepit. There's no question about that. What was your favorite part of the whole thing, Emily?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. So my favorite, it depends on which day. Mm-hmm. We have the high school tournament on one day,
right,
and we have the middle school tournament on the second day. And my favorite moment from the high school tournament was we had some character interpreters there. Mr. Madison was representing
yes, he did a great
Montpelier,
job, too.
Of course, and Patrick Henry was representing Colonial Williamsburg, and they were having a debate amongst themselves. And at one point, there was a crack comment made about women's inability to vote. There was a straw poll going on about whether or not the people in the audience would accept the new constitution, and people began to raise their hands, and it was posited that the ladies in the crowd should not have the ability to vote yes or no.
Seriously? Was that Madison who suggested that, or Henry?
That was Henry that suggested that.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me too much. Yeah, well, I imagine that got a bit of a rise.
That did get quite a good reaction, so I thought that was actually pretty entertaining. But it is, you know, the moment when we get to announce the awards is always great. So that was a lot of fun. And for middle school students, just the whole day is a buzz with excitement.
Right.
12 and 13-year-olds have a level of energy that most of us would love to just have a fraction of. And the level of energy that they bring to their competition is just really inspiring.
Can I add a dissonant note to that, though?
You may.
Okay, because I love the middle school competition, except for that part of it, because it kills my ears. There's nothing quite like the screech of a sixth or seventh or eighth grade girl who's screaming for her team, and it just about kills me each year.
I'm sorry about that, but
absolutely.
I do appreciate the enthusiasm.
Yeah, the enthusiasm is great, except for the ear-splitting aspect. No, I'm actually going to agree with you. I think the cuteness factor is enormous.
So I do wish, Stuart, that we had the opportunity to congratulate some of Jack's teammates who are at state finals.
Yes.
Douglas Freeman sent two teams to Virginia state finals. The teams came in second and third place overall, which is really phenomenal.
Fantastic, because Virginia is an extremely competitive state.
It's a very competitive state,
right.
Exactly. And so our first place team gets the invitation to go to national finals, but we found out a couple of weeks after finals were over that Virginia also would be given a wild card spot at national finals, which means that we got to send our second place team as well, which is Jack's fellow teammates on the second Douglas Freeman team.
Well, that's tremendous. Congratulations to Douglas Freeman again. So I will be saying, are you going to be at Nationals this year?
I will be at Nationals,
okay,
absolutely.
Well, I will be there as well. I'm going to be judging at Nationals, and so that's very, very exciting. Well, this is tremendous, and I always enjoy talking about We the People. Anything you want to add to our conversation before we wrap it up, Jack?
Sure. I think just generally the entire process of going through We the People was so much more than this final moment where we talked about some of the culmination of it, but it was such a months-long process that was just so engaging every day, where we were going to school and reading law review articles and debating and talking and working with Mr. Peck and with our classmates. And it was just a phenomenal experience where those of us, like I am, who have always been interested, or at least for a very long time been interested in issues of government, were able to get involved, as well as students who are less interested. And we all kind of ended up being just really happy working together and engaged and working to answer these questions in ways that sometimes present more answers than we were even given in the first place. And I think that was a really, really rewarding process that we really don't see anywhere else in school these days.
I fully agree. Any final thoughts from you, Emily?
I just want to wish Jack the best of luck as he heads off to college next year, and I'm really glad that the We the People program was such a great experience as part of your senior year.
Yeah, speaking of college, Jack, all those other places that you've been accepted, those are places for bad people to go to college. They're filled with bad people and bad professors, and they cheat on their sports teams, and so don't go to any of those, okay?
I will heed that advice.
Okay, thanks very much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Christy Wagner of the Southwest Virginia CASA program. Thanks also to Emily Voss and Jack Lohman for talking to me about the We the People program. Remember, the Constitution covers kids, too. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.